Well, like I said, Peter is finishing up a talk, actually, on South Africa's World Cup, so he'll be in the football mindset when he joins us in a little bit. For those of you, and there's a few of you who I have not talked to before, I'm glad that we're getting the word out on the group and that everyone's doing their job in spreading the good word. So I know through a couple of our fellow formers, we have some new people on board, so I just want to introduce myself. My name is Alex. I'm a second-year graduate student here at Michigan State, and my research deals with football clubs in Argentina in the 1950s and 60s, and I'm very excited to finally move the group towards an explicit discussion of women's football. We've had it come up in some of the other works that we've done, but this is our first and by no means last turn, and maybe we can start going regionally after this. But we sort of had a grab bag of readings for this week, and it's the first time we're not having sort of an explicit author to present to us. So the conversation is going to be fairly open-ended. We can talk about research methods. We can talk about nuances in the work that we looked at. I see Cynthia Pelak, actually, speaking of authors, is looking to join us. So let me shut up for just a moment, and everyone else can sort of introduce themselves. We can start with Brenda. I think everyone has the same sort of lineup that I do in front of me. I have Brenda, then Andrew, then David Kies, and David Roberts. So we can all sort of just introduce ourselves very briefly, just say who you are and your research interests in football, if any, and we'll start with Brenda.
Hi, I'm assistant professor of history at Hofstra, and my book is coming out this year on the history of soccer and politics in Chile. And I'm sorry that I won't contribute so much given, like I said, the really noisy small children. Here in New York, it's spring break, but I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Great. And Andrew?
Yeah, hi, Andrew Guest. I'm at the University of Portland. My main research interests are sort of football and development, sports and development, and Africa, but also some in American soccer. So try to do a little bit of online writing when I can.
And David Roberts?
Hi, I'm David. I am a PhD student at the University of Toronto, finishing up this summer. My research is on the World Cup in South Africa, mainly around security planning and the impacts on local communities.
Great. And our next David?
I think that's me, is it? Yeah. I'm David Toms. I'm a second-year PhD student in UCC in Ireland, and my research revolves around field sports in the province of Munster, 1880 to 1930, including soccer, which is what I'm working on at the moment.
Fantastic. And David Kies just hopped in on the conversation. You can go ahead and introduce yourself, David.
Can you guys hear me?
Yep.
Yep.
Okay. Wasn't sure if I'd hit the mute. I'm David Kies. I'm a PhD student in Department of Anthropology at the University of California, San Diego. And I'm doing my research about post-World War II soccer in the United States, how soccer has quote-unquote gone mainstream, and the relationship between soccer and immigrant communities and soccer in the mainstream. So.
Great. How about John?
Oh, hi, everyone. I'm John Turnbull. I live in Atlanta. I've done a website, The Global Game, for several years, and particular interests are in literature on football, and did a literary collection with a couple of friends a couple of years ago, also called The Global Game, and have been interested in women's football and written about it for several years now. Thanks.
Yeah, and John's a returning author for us, so it's always good to see you all come back. I know Laurent is joining us from a lab, so I'm not sure if he wants to introduce himself, but we'll come back to him.
I'll say hi quickly. I'm going to keep my thing on mute because I don't want to interrupt, but my name's Laurent Dubois. I'm at Duke University and write about French soccer mostly, and excited to be on this conversation.
Thanks. And another returning author for us. And finally, Tom McKay.
Can folks hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Tom McCabe from Rutgers, Newark, and do some U.S. soccer history, working on a New Jersey-based project right now.
Fantastic. And Cynthia has just joined us, so...
Hello.
Yeah, we can hear you fine. Do you want to introduce yourself real quick?
Hi. I'm Cynthia Pellick, and I'm a sociologist at the New Mexico State University. And my areas generally are race, class, gender intersections, and sport is an area in which I look at race, class, gender, and done research on South African and the women's game in South Africa.
Yes, and thank you very much for joining us. I know Peter had brought you on board, so we'll have an author with us, which is fantastic. And finally, first, thank you to Jennifer Doyle for sort of taking on part of the convener task off my hands. So I sincerely appreciate that. And Jennifer has written quite a bit about the women's game, so I'll let her introduce herself. And Jennifer is going to sort of start us off with a few comments on the readings that I hope everyone's been able to get to or look over for a little bit. And I'm very excited because this is the first time our discussion can be fairly organic in the sense that we won't have, well, we do have Cynthia here to bounce ideas off about her particular article, but usually it was us sort of asking questions about the book that we had written. So I hope this conversation can be a little bit more open and we can follow these tangents wherever they may. So Jennifer, the ball is with you. You can do Hi. What you like with it.
Okay. So my name is Jennifer Doyle, and I teach at the University of California, Riverside. My background is actually in gender studies, performance studies, and visual culture. And I've been blogging at From a Left Wing since December 2007, I think. And that's morphed into a scholarly project that's a visual studies project, which I'm calling The Athletic Gesture, and what will probably be a collection of essays that expand on some of the work I've been doing on the blog. So, and thanks for inviting me to convene and lead discussion a little bit on women's soccer. I'm so glad to have Cynthia here because her essay is one of my favorite reads in the field. So this is my first participation in the Football Scholars Forum. So I'm struggling at just even talking at my computer.
No worries. It's, we can take the conversation wherever we like. We can tackle each reading one at a time, or I'm not sure if you wanted to have a theme that we focus on, or
yeah, I can talk a little bit about where I'm at,
sure,
right, as a feminist scholar coming into working on writing about the specific sport. The sort of collective picture that I kind of see emerging from this reading, or just if one reads around in terms of academic writing or critical and scholarly writing about the women's game, sort of some pretty big issues and problems surface pretty consistently. So I'll say what some of those things are. I get this ringing when people are calling in. Is that normal? Like,
yeah,
like that. I just ignore it. Okay.
Yeah, John should be joining us. John, we're midway here, but we can hop in. Jennifer is just taking us off in discussion, and Peter has just walked in the room, so I'm gonna take my headphones off, and we're with you now. Jennifer, continue, please.
All right. One of the things that I find really one of the things that I find very provocative about Jean Williams's work in general, and that also comes across when you read the entirety of Barbara Jacobs's The Dick Kerr's Ladies, is how much of the history of women's soccer is constantly being forgotten. And in like local sites where you would think actually there would be a pretty sustained awareness and conversation with women's soccer, saturated with media and scholarship on the sport, but also in terms of internationally, when you start like looking at a scholarship on women's soccer, much of that is actually often about debunking myths about it not being played, about it not being popular, and just kind of a continual need to actually recover even fairly recent histories in women's soccer. That's kind of familiar to me as a feminist scholar working in literary studies, insofar as certainly there have been periods whereby there's been like an active attempt at recovering women's literature, women's writing in the 19th century, for example. So some of that's really familiar and from an academic perspective also really interesting, and then challenging on a methodological level insofar as there's so little media attention to the women's game, that much of the actual, you know, the research, the most useful research is, you know, somebody like Barbara Jacobs, you know, sat down with people who were really directly involved with the women's game and their kids and their family members and went through scrapbooks and the like, really labor-intensive archival research. And there's just a really broad need for that. So on an academic level, I feel this very particular gratitude for the people who've been actually taking that stuff on because it's so important. And then one of the other big issues for me was something that hit me when I was reading actually Cynthia's article on South African, the women's game in South Africa. In this, she can talk about the article in more detail, but one of the things, I think it was maybe the third or fourth article on the history of the women's game in a country that followed more or less the same arc, which is at the moment that FIFA took on the organization of a Women's World Cup and more or less forced the existing women's game in that country to be administered by the FIFA-affiliated national program. It caused havoc and really set things backwards to a certain degree for national team programs. In England, this is very much the case, where the early 1990s was a very difficult period for the women's game. In terms of the English FA's involvement with the national team and also with the attempt at sort of organizing a national league. India was a place where I was doing some research, very very light research, but it's really clear that the involvement of the All India Football Federation actually makes things much worse and harder for women than if they were just actually left alone. And then Cynthia's article has telling stories about how hard it is how hard it was in the 1990s for players and men and women involved with the women's game to address corruption, harassment, any kind of issues like that by working within the South African Football Association. And that story, I was reminded of that story in recent newspaper coverage of two female players who were dropped from the squad going into the African Championship came forward and there's no one to file a complaint against, but they came forward with a complaint that the national team coach had basically been molesting players. And he was eventually forced out, but he'd been in that position for a really long time, and it doesn't take much asking around to see that this is a more or less openly known fact, right, that this guy had been prowling the dormitories and saying really homophobic things while also making sexual advances at players, that he would select the squad according to who was cooperating and who wasn't, and that there's just absolutely no apparatus to which a player or manager or anyone could actually turn to address this, because the kinds of things that we have via Title IX in the United States are really unique. And so where I've been at, just sort of in terms of my blog and going into the Women's World Cup, has really been thinking about, you know, asking the question of, you know, we tend to assume that FIFA's involvement with the women's game is a positive. Certainly there are ways in which that's true. But I've been trying to imagine, well, what would actually an international women's tournament be like, or what would the international women's game be like if national team programs didn't have to go through the existing men's programs? Like, it's not a given to me that FIFA's involvement in the women's game is actually a positive thing for the highest levels of women's football on a global level, in terms of, you know, a program like South Africa or India or England for that matter, right? So,
it might be a good place to start.
And
I mean, South Africa might be a great place to start.
Reading this material,
No, I was going to say that if we want to kick off the conversation, South Africa might be a great place to start, since we have Cynthia on board and Peter's just joined us as well.
Yeah.
All right, I'll jump in if that's appropriate.
Sure.
This is Cynthia. One thing that is important to realize in terms of when there was trouble within with the women's game in South Africa, and Johannesburg in particular, that it was the strength of the newly acquired mechanisms within the state that were used to respond to those troubles. So it was the new sort of gender mainstreaming framework within the country. It was the commitment of the new South Africa to become not only a non-racial state, but also a non-sexist state. So they, the women soccer players, relied upon those new mechanisms for gender equality that forced SAFA, the National Football Association, to address some of those issues. So it was the strength of the opportunities and the resources within the government of the state that was able to push the national organization to look at yourself. So it was a judicial commission that was started by sort of the office of the president. So that came outside of football. So I think this issue of the strength of the women's game, because of the associations with the male-dominated associations, it becomes real important to see what is the status of women in the society in general, and what resources and tools do they have to address or to resist sexual harassment, or to resist the lack of resources, or to, you know, to grow coaches and referees. And so, you know, it's important to keep that larger context of the status of women to really understand what women's experiences are within the game. That's all.
I think, Jennifer's back on. I think we'd lost you for a second.
Yeah. So I just right at the end, I think, of Cynthia's comments, or maybe she was brought to an end by my just disappearance. I have a question for you, though, which is that, because one of the things that I was writing about on my blog and I got really moved by was the campaigns from within the feminist community regarding the murder of Yudi Simelane. I don't have a sense that there's been a very strong reaction to this from SAFA. And then the state organizations to which women could turn during the period that you cover it in your article, there doesn't seem to be any kind of a faith in certainly in the police or the judicial apparatus to actually address the situation for women generally in South Africa as victims of sexual violence. And this seems to be actually, you know, it's playing itself out in terms of the development of the game. I don't know if you've been following things there now. I was wondering if you had any comments about South African women's football now.
And if you might want to preface that with some details on the murder for...
Okay. There was...
Go ahead. Yeah, sorry.
Go ahead, Jennifer.
Well, I'm always scandalized that people don't know it, so I'll just politicize that, all right, because a national team player for the women's side, a retired player, although she's still active in her local team. John Turnbull was actually one of the people who really turned me onto the story in more of its detail, but she was assaulted, gang raped, and murdered. She was also a referee and a very active member of the footballing community locally. Her murder was covered by European or English newspapers as part of a wave of what's called corrective rape, of particularly violent attacks on women that are identified as gay. So they're black butch lesbians, and it seems to have a pretty big impact on the footballing community insofar as women's football, as is the case in a lot of countries, is coded as a masculine a thing, right, an unwomanly thing. And one of the kind of positive aspects of that is that women's football can be a very queer space and a safe space for queer women. And certainly there's a really interesting lesbian feminist footballing community in South Africa. So Yudisa Milane was sort of part of this, or her story is now something that's definitely a part of a political awareness, right, among women soccer players, and a site of activism in the lesbian feminist community in South Africa. So, and FIFA has done absolutely nothing to talk about this, address this. There's absolutely nothing for the Women's World Cup that I can see acknowledging Yudi's murder, the fight against violence against women in South Africa, or even just like the impact of sexism and homophobia on the women's game. I don't even see programming coming from feminist organizations in Germany that's addressing these things, which I find kind of scandalous. I'm cranky about this stuff.
Yeah. Isn't there also...
In terms of what I observed studying in the late 90s and early 2000s, the issues of sexuality and lesbianism within soccer was not as high profile as it is today. And it may speak to some of the themes from the reading in terms of the shifting context in which women have to negotiate within the game. And I think this individual who was brutally murdered helped to bring this issue of corrective rape and violence against women and sexual assault much more public and international attention. The women's soccer players, this happening to one of the national players, gave the issue visibility, but this is an issue facing all South African women in terms of the brutal history of the last, 300 years has, in terms of today, has just seeped into the general culture. And I also think that within this last decade, as women's soccer has become more visible within the sport, within the country, that is part of the resistance, is part of the control of women in the game. So I think the issues of sexuality are coming more to the fore in South Africa and in Africa in general. And it is something that women in the 90s didn't deal with because of the lack of visibility of the game. And so it goes back to who's controlling the women's game how are women then negotiating those contexts in order to maintain their foothold.
Hello, this is Martha. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. Hey, I'm glad to be here. I have not worked on this in South Africa, but a colleague of mine was doing some work in Port Elizabeth, and she had some interesting, not a full story, but just some insights. And there was a team, a relatively successful team in Port Elizabeth that was doing some community work, so going out and working with younger kids and coaching soccer. Both boys and girls, and there were some, lesbians on the team, and there was some concern that, well, maybe the kids would be exposed and the parents would be upset, so, lesbians and all that. But in the end, it seemed that that was put aside because the team was successful enough that the kids looked up to these players because they were well known within the community, and so the kids, and at least the families and everybody was, they looked past. It didn't seem to matter as much that they were lesbian, but more so that they were providing this coaching for the kids. So I think that, that there might be spaces where, at least in certain moments, when the sexuality issues are there for women athletes, sometimes it can be put aside. And it may not be something that lasts all the time. It may depend on who's part of the group, but at least that was somewhat encouraging when I heard that.
I was wondering if John could talk a little bit about the time that he spent with the Chosen Few and his encounters with lesbian feminist soccer players in South Africa.
Yeah, hi, this is John Turnbull. Sure, I'm glad to. I don't know, I just broaden it a bit. The South African experience is not unlike experiences I've had writing about women's football almost anywhere, and that's that happens under the radar. It's not surprising to me that people don't know Edie Simelane or what happened to her. You know, whereas I'm not sure what a comparable situation would be with a male national team player, but if a male national team player had been murdered, I guess you could look to Andres Escobar in Colombia for parallel. There'd be no end to it, and the grassroots organizing and peace work that's been done through football was started a lot based on Escobar's murder in 94 in Colombia. The thing about women's football, and that when I read Jean Wayne's work and read her books and talked to her before, the theme that comes out is the lack of interest in quotidian experience of women, regardless of what it is. And it happens to be sport in this case. It happens to be football. But in South Africa, that was the sense that I got from the lesbian players on the Chosen Few team in Johannesburg, that they were empowered individually by the game. The fact that it wasn't part of a nationwide conversation wasn't of concern to them, but they were doing it as a statement of personal independence and proclamation and freedom building. And football was assisting in that sense of individual freedom that they could get. And as I would say about sport generally, and writing about sport and writing about soccer in particular, is the quotidian aspects of the game are of little interest, which is amazing because to me that's the most interesting thing. And the themes that come up again and again about writing about women's soccer over the years is that we're so little, or media is so little ready, or academics are so little ready to go into the personal dimension of these players' lives and what it takes for them. The resistance that they face, and every story about women's soccer that I've written, and that's why I love writing about it, involves a conflict of some kind, and I think that's why it's inherently interesting, is that almost anything that's happened in women's soccer for an individual or in a group has evolved out of a resistance. And that's true for this lesbian team in South Africa, and that's true for the Yudi Simelane story and her teammates, and is that they've gotten to where they are out of a resistance and out of conflict.
I wanted to go take that sort of dimension of what I love the way John writes and talks about the sport in general, but also with the women's game too. That I think you're very eloquent at actually naming some of the things that make stories about women's soccer really compelling. And it's not that different from what makes the men's game compelling. But sometimes it's like you're talking in a room full of pillows where you can tell the story and it seems like nobody's actually listening. And then the story doesn't get retold. It just gets told once and then it gets forgotten. But back to the anecdote that Martha was relaying regarding like the way a community of people react to players that they are, you know, identify as lesbian or who identify themselves as lesbian. And it's like no big deal, right? Once people have their initial kind of reaction, which is disengaged from a real collaboration with those women, that a lot of the issues that come up around sexuality in the women's game are really disconnected from what, you know, like from people. It seems like it's sort of an institutional anxiety, deep conflict on how to represent the women's game, and this is coming from national football federations and advertisers and things like this, and a complete lack of generosity in terms of imagining what the fan of the women's game wants, and a total disconnect from it. Like, I love Barbara Jacobs's book, because you read this book and you learn that these women who were, you know, working class, gender non-conforming, cigar-smoking, off, you know, many of them certainly not married with children, and some shacked up with women. You know, they were celebrities. You know, they weren't just, you know, popular players. They were, you know, there was a sort of a culture of celebrity around them and a real active interest in them, certainly because their behavior was sort of scandalous. But that, you would say that is absolutely true of the male players who we find all over the tabloids, right? I mean, it's their off-field behavior that's often actually selling the newspapers. You know, and then the English FA ban was about as much managing that capacity of a women's game to put women into the public sphere in this way. You know, and similarly, like, I mean, Jean Williams's book, she talks about the kind of traces in newspapers of the popularity of the women's game in South Africa. I think there was one instance where she's sort of referencing something, kind of repeating kind of popular discourse about there being a lot of interest in the women's game. You know, that interest in the women's game is very, I don't think it's that different from interest in the men's game, in terms of people want to see it played, they want to see it played well. They're going, you know, like, they're interested actually in the culture of women's football, you know, in its particularities and also in its unruliness. And that unruliness there's a frisson attached to that, which is absolutely about gender and sexuality and the ways in which these women butt up against that. You know, I'm becoming increasingly convinced that one of the great sort of difficulties around the women's game, and you see this, I think, as you'll see on my blog, even in just sort of the anxious, you know, fashion, you know, that the U.S. women's national team would be sent, they're going to be, you know, that uniform is just like a statement of gender anxiety. I mean, it's like, it's baffling, you know, and this seems to me to be one of the things that actually holds back the development of the women's game. And it's in spite of, you know, I don't understand what would happen if we started to actually publicly acknowledge that Marta is gay, and she's not closeted, right? The closeting of Marta, the fact that Marta's a lesbian, is something that's happened on the level of the media, and a just sort of collaborative silence in which no one ever mentions her personal life ever, as is, you know, the case with lesbian athletes, you know, I mean, the WNBA or in tennis and the like, you know. Like, what if people imagine would happen, that the game would fall apart, that suddenly, you know, the whole country of Brazil would stop being the national team? Obviously not, you know. Anyway. All right, I'm trying not to rant for too long.
Could I hop in, actually, and just ask Jennifer one thing? You mentioned very briefly class. How much do you think that actually has an impact on how kind of women in these teams kind of create their identity as, you know, as a group and stuff? Do you think that it's a particularly strong element? And sometimes do you think it maybe overrides either gender or sexuality, or do you think it's always kind of bouncing off one another?
I think it's bouncing off of one another. And I could say, I mean, I think that some of the other members of this group can speak with more detail about different women's football communities. But I would cite the Hackney Women's Football Club. As sort of, I played on that team for a year. And there's a woman named Jane Caldwell, I think that's Jane Caldwell, who's written about Hackney Women's Football Club for Soccer and Society. And they're mostly, not only now, but they're, you know, I'd say very strongly identified with a queer working class kind of politics. So, you know, absolutely, but I don't know. I've sort of lost track of the question, which is,
just kind of how much do you think class is important to them, say, as well as gender or sexuality?
Yeah, I don't think you can tease them apart. So, I mean, I'm thinking of the Hackney Women's Football Club partly because there's a kind of class consciousness in what is also a lesbian feminist footballing environment. But to point to here, for example, class really, really divides the women's game, does with the men's game as well, very dramatically, and especially at the youth level, insofar as, and that's not just class, it's also racialized, and it's about histories of immigration within specific communities. So in California, you know, you'll have extraordinarily talented young women players who have no opportunity to play in their schools because they're schools that are not in online compliance, and they're also under-resourced generally. And their best training opportunities are in traveling clubs, which, of course, they can't afford to join. But within, like, within California, within sort of independent community leagues, Latin leagues, there'll be a very strong sense of identity. That's not some, you know, again, it's not only class oriented, but class is absolutely, I'd say economic differences are one of the strongest and most, you know, materially visible, things dividing people. With sexuality, that's very interesting outside the U.S. especially, but also within Latino communities, because the game is so coded as working class and as masculine, that one of the things that can, I mean, certainly I'd say in Los Angeles, one of the things that I, you know, like I love about women's soccer, and certainly when you're kind of connecting with women players here, is that, you know, you meet a lot of really exciting, like 16, 17 year old lesbian girls, right? Who've been out, you know, as long as they were sort of aware of themselves as sexual beings, and then also wear like a really fantastic style that's, you know, a bit cholo and like really specific. And that's also, you know, connected to their participation in a soccer environment, right? So I don't know. So I'm just, you know, I think that's a kind of a queerness that I find in the sort of Latin scene. In my own involvement with local leagues, that you know, it plays out really differently in a Jersey suburb, for example.
Okay.
I don't know if that's helpful.
No, it is. It's just interesting to kind of think of it that way, I guess. It's not something that I know particularly a great deal about, because kind of, you know, I suppose being on the other side of the pond, the sort of perception I get of American women's soccer is very, very, very diluted, even compared to what you might pick up in the US. So I'm just kind of interested to think about that way, because certainly the impression you get being in Ireland and in the UK is that it's very much sort of a pursuit of middle class women rather than necessarily a working class thing. But kind of the more I'm looking into it, the more it seems to have a much more sort of kind of, I suppose, working class kind of element to it as well. So I'm just kind of,
with the LA Soul, for example, the women's team, the WPS professional women's team that was here in Los Angeles in the first season, you saw like a lot of those young women in the stands. At my first match, I actually sat behind four lesbians who were on a double date, and they were also, none of them was over 18. I mean, they were young, and, you know, tattooed, hair slicked back, long, long kind of cholo ponytail sort of look. I mean, I was sitting behind these girls and I was like, oh man, you know, if the WPS knew how to embrace them as fans, they'd have a much sexier advertising sort of look, you know. And then the next summer, actually, I was organizing a women's team, and one of those girls was wound up being our goalkeeper. Found, you know, totally randomly. and they were, you know, they were playing together on a team actually that plays in an independent league, pretty much in the shadow of Carson Stadium. So, and that is kind of like a thing that's off the official record in terms of, especially outside the United States, and representations of the women's game, but also internal to the United States, when people talk about the U.S. women's national team and the like, that this dimension of the game, which is not the suburban or NCAA college thing, right, just gets kind of, it's as if it doesn't exist and as if it's never been there. But there's been there's like a 14 divisions in the Orange County Women's League, which is an independently run league that was started in the 1970s. I mean,
yeah,
you know, there's a rich, complicated women's scene, just as there is for the men.
Yeah.
I would just echo that for Northern California, too, that you have a lot of women playing in all sorts of different divisions and going up and down. And then up here, there's also, and I haven't been there for ages, but the tournament, the Festival of the Babes soccer tournament that had gone back and forth between here and Canada on Labor Day weekend, and it's a tournament. It's a seven-a-side tournament, and it's all about fun and community, and it's a tournament where you can anybody can go to it, but you just have to be okay with being mistaken as a lesbian. And so it's you know, it's great. Although I think it was almost this year. I think it was almost not going to happen, but then the folks up in Vancouver, I think, have decided to make sure it happened. Or maybe in Portland, I can't. I think
if it ever comes to that again, I volunteer myself to organize one in LA.
Yeah.
The Festival of the Babes is internationally renowned for being a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the t-shirts are really great to have. but yeah, the thing with class, it definitely, you know, it's just in the United States, it takes a lot of money to play soccer and get your game up to the point where you can, you know, and then to advance to the national team where you would be seen around the world. It really takes a lot of money or a certain amount of, I don't want to say luck so much, but, you know, having a sponsor or someone to move you through, all the things that you have to do. And it's, you know, for many, and this is for the boys and girls as well. It's just super hard if you don't have that kind of system to move through, you know, beyond, I don't know, my son's on a team now. It's an under 17 team, and everybody on the team is Chicano except for my son. And you know, they're really good. Maybe one or two of them might go to college. But you know, the best players, they're looking to go play in Mexico. They're not headed towards the U.S. national team at all. And then the women's game is so, the youth women's game is so very different up here. You know, the top teams, yeah, most of the Latina players don't end up on the top teams, let alone, you know, African-American players don't. Very, well, some of them, if they're in sort of the suburban circles or in Berkeley, it's a little different. Yeah, it's definitely, it's not some, I mean, it's a monetary thing to a large extent, and there's, yeah, it's not a street game, that's for sure, so people are not picking up the game in the street, you have to sort of pay to play.
Yeah, one of the other reading recommendations I wanted to make, especially for those on the other side of the pond, is Pete Davies' I Lost My Heart to the Bells. And he follows the Doncaster Bells for a season. And this was in, I want to say, 1992. And so it's a pretty traditional kind of soccer book where you follow for a season. But it just so happens that the year that followed them, the team had been the subject of a BBC documentary, the name of which it's gone right out of my head. And FA was really scandalized by the documentary, which basically just showed them, you know, playing their matches, going out to the pub, pounding beers, having a good time. and they're from, you know, so Bells, so they're also, you know, they don't talk in a very ladylike way. And the team received, you know, a harsh letter from the FA chastising them for their behavior, their unladylike behavior. And a number of the that team was like the Arsenal, right, of its generation in terms of Arsenal ladies, and overwhelmingly dominant. And so a lot of the national team players were actually from the Donny Bells and were shuffled around, like one who had been captained had her captaincy removed, and some players were dropped off the team. And there's some really poignant writing there also, because I think a coach had been brought in for the national team who was not that experienced as a coach, never mind as a women's coach. And it was like, you know, their behavior was really regulated, and it pushed a lot of women off the national team entirely. And that's another interesting thing about the women's game that's very different from the men's game at the highest levels, which is that there's no real reward for playing on your national team other than the honor of it. There's very little in terms of money. There's very little incentive to stay at the highest level of the game, because you're really sacrificing a lot in terms of your job, you know, a job, any kind of economic stability, you know, this will bring nothing to you. And so when women players endure harassment or just deep incompetence, and, you know, when as athletes, there's just no, to stick with it. And that's another kind of on a like a macro level, another problem that that women players face over the duration, especially the most talented.
Yeah, just speaking on a macro level, one of the things that I was hoping to be able to tie in from Cynthia's work was, you know, her discussion of the Judicial Commission in South Africa, and maybe comparing that sort of a legal intervention by the state to say something like Title IX in the United States, and sort of using that to sort of piggyback off a discussion about maybe the importance of comparative studies and in looking at the women's game. But just maybe a sort of general question to throw out there, you know, comparatively, how have these sorts of legal interventions worked, something like Title IX versus something like the Judicial Commission that worked in South Africa?
Cynthia, do you want to start and just sort of say a little bit about how that worked?
What I didn't say earlier is that as a result of this judicial intervention, it was then in which SAFA, the national organization, took over women's soccer. Yeah. So again, you have, you know, a dilemma to bring the state in, to bring the gendered state in or the sexist state in, may in some ways you may find relief, but it was actually that judicial commission that sort of lost the autonomy for the women's game. So in order to deal with the sexism and the sexual harassment, the violence in the game, in order to call SAFA to account and be more responsive, meant that SAFA actually gained more power. So it's always a tricky endeavor. And I don't think there are any easy answers for that.
To bring that around to the United States and Title IX, like this was a very big issue in relationship to women's participation in the NCAA, you know, whereas lot of women involved with the women's game, a lot of people involved with the women's game had very serious misgivings about what it would mean to have the administration of women's sports brought under NCAA, which comes as a surprise to a lot of people now. And so far as I think people take the benefits of that as being kind of a given, although, you know, there's a whole other conversation to have about that. One of the interesting things that came out of some of my conversations with folks, I was just in South Africa for just 2 weeks again. It was a slightly different kind of research project that's about artists and curatorial engagement with the World Cup. But speaking to a couple people about asking questions about the activism around Yudisa Malane, and also on an international level, what queer athletes would like to see happen. And one of the things that, you know, we were talking about was something like the IOC, for example, adopting some kind of a rule regarding the prohibition of discrimination by sexuality or gender identity. Which is kind of a mind-bending thing when you start to think about it, because if you take that far enough, that should actually call into question the absolute segregation of men's and women's sports and raise, you know, put more pressure on the ways in which that category of women is, policed around hormone levels now. But, you know, separately, what she was, you know, we were talking about was how there's no, you know, in terms of, like, for example, the Nigerian women's, the coach of the Nigerian women's team, in March at a conference on Nigerian women's football, apparently made a whole speech, the content of which was about how she eradicated lesbianism from the squad. And, you know, Peter Scolari says something offhanded about not having gay players on the team, and that makes headlines. But, you know, coach of the Nigerian women's team, which is one of the strongest sides going into the World Cup, gives an entire speech about this, and, you know, the international sports media could care less. I mean, they could absolutely care less, you know, and You know, it's unclear to me, like, what the athletes who are kind of having to struggle with this, to where they turn, you know, and if it's more helpful to have something internal to the, you know, to your sort of your national government, or if this isn't someplace where FIFA could actually be useful. You know, I mean, Title IX, the difference between, I mean, Title IX is closer to sports, right? Title IX is actually about just about gender equity. And then it's, you know, we always think about this in relationship to sports, but it's actually something that, especially as academics, it codes all of our experiences in the workplace. But one of the interesting things in terms of looking at soccer is that one of the biggest game-changing sort of lawsuits in Title IX is actually against Anson Dorrance at UNC Chapel Hill, in which his own tendency to use sexually inappropriate language in his coaching practice was a problem. And, you know, a player who tried to confront that was dropped from the team. She filed a complaint, and that complaint went through the system. And the end product of that complaint is that, like, homophobic language and sexist language and sexually explicit jokes can contribute to a hostile work environment. Until that case, that had not actually been established, that a hostile work environment could be created rhetorically, right? That you didn't actually have to, say, put your hand on someone or, you know, molest them physically or get into kind of quid pro quo thing in terms of the exchange of sexual favors, but that a hostile work environment might actually come up, speech acts, you know. That I would think has had a very profound impact on coach, you know, like the space of coaching, but it also has a profound impact on all of our work, right? Insofar as this is something that no one has to, you know, none of us have to put up with that. So I think I'm taking this out of a little bit of a tangential thing, but, you know, it's a very positive thing in terms of just for the experiences of athletes, regardless of their gender, in terms of just putting up, having to deal with these kinds of things. And very few athletes have any kind of recourse to that, it seems. So, and then it's also like that kind of weird thing whereby FIFA and football associations are kind of worlds, they're like worlds unto themselves. I think people participating in those programs at that level, it's like, I'm not even sure it's clear that an athlete working, you know, an athlete on a national team would think of herself and the things that she goes through as something that could be, or she could turn to, employment law, for example, as something to help her, right, in her national context. I don't know.
We'll do.
In general, you know, in Europe with the labor laws and things like that, I mean, I think for male players, it's also, you know, what right do athletes have? Or with the player in Bahrain who's been taken off the team because of the standing up to the government. But I just want to emphasize or sort of reiterate sort of what you're saying is that a lot of the issues around equality, you know, affect both gay and straight and, you know, bisexual players. I mean, they affect all female players. And because it creates such an atmosphere where you feel like you have to step in a line in a certain way, you know, if you're, it really makes it, it conditions the way that everybody has to play. And I think it varies from country to country. And, you know, here in the United States, we still have issues on all kinds of teams, not just all kinds of sports, not just football, soccer. But I think overseas, and Cynthia had said something earlier, when she was there in the 90s, the issues of, you know, being a lesbian weren't that much out. And my observations were in the African context writ large. There, in the 90s, there wasn't much discussion about lesbianism. But as women's football began to get a bigger, more kids were playing, more people were playing, and there was more news media, it did start to everywhere become more and more, much more of an issue and be then used against women or somehow to keep them in line. And it was interesting that the Nigerian team, when they were in playing against Equatorial Guinea in the last African Women's World Cup, they were very incensed that they thought that the Equatorial Guinea team had players on the team who were men. And they had a complaint against that team. So these are things, though, that came out. That the whole issue around women being lesbians in the, at least my reading of the African news, and that it is, it, as the game has grown, that concern has grown. And I don't know fully how to explain it, but or what all the different mechanisms are, but it strikes me as very interesting that as the game gets developed, this is much more of an issue.
The guys have been really quiet.
Mm-hmm.
I'll chime in on just the impact of Title IX in a certain locale. I mean, I was just kind of looking at some stuff, and so it gets signed in June of 1972. By that fall, there are 11 girls' high school soccer teams in the state of New Jersey. 10 years later, 150. And now today, over 500. So, I mean, you can just see the amount of access that's been granted through that legislation. And then also in the town that I grew up, which is northern New Jersey, about 15 miles west of Manhattan, you start in the late 70s to get girls who were playing with boys now joining other girls on all-female teams. And that was contested because some of the girls belonged at the higher level with the boys. So now they have to make these decisions. Do I go and play with the girls, or do I go and play and remain with the boys? So I always found that pretty interesting. And, you know, in this setting in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s, you know, the beginning of it all. You know, what somebody calls this kind of quiet revolution, explodes in New Jersey and other places.
Tom, I have a question for you. Is your research on New Jersey soccer, is it around the women's game, or is it not?
No, it's New Jersey and national in focus, but I've been picking up, you know, stuff about the women's game along the way, and hope to include that. But no, it's on the male side of the aisle.
I'm like, you have to. I'm like, I'm. Oh wait, or the match? Maybe only two. Well, there's maybe one home match so far. So they're my favorite team in the WPS because that's where I'm from. So, neither here nor there. So I was wondering, you know, if there are people in the group though who have things that they want to talk about with the reading that we have, because we've been actually talking kind of around the reading. Partly because of some of the issues I'm talking about, that's really kind of my own agenda in terms of my work. So
yeah, we were. We tried to sort of pick readings that would sort of get us to this kind of a conversation anyway. So I'm pleased that we've been talking about what we'll be talking about, especially with contemporary affairs. But yeah, I mean, if we want to turn to the readings, I mean, the reason we carved up Longman like we did was exactly this, to bring up, you know, the issues of coaching the collegiate level and the national team level for the U.S. women's team and throughout the 90s, and also to, you know, have Chastain's celebratory photo and the sort of media ruckus that it caused sort of form as a act as sort of a lightning rod for us to be able to discuss the meaning of sexualized images of female athletes in the United States and Chastain's role in that and her teammates' take on it. I think Longman does a good job of sort of contextualize, you know, giving quite a bit of context for Chastain's celebration, and also, you know, if anyone's read the rest of Longman, you know, maybe talking about race and class and gender as we have in South Africa and in the United States setting outside of California, as it comes up in Longman's book, might be a good idea. But we might just start with sort of reactions to Longman, yeah, since we've talked about Cynthia's work, and Williams, this has come up a little bit as well. It's feeling too much like seminar now.
Yeah, that's why I'm laughing too. I'm just like, oh wait, I just went through this yesterday. One of the things that I really liked about one of the moments in the Longman that I enjoyed reading was I'm going to forget who was talking about who, but it was you know, one where the coach was talking about the differences between coaching men and women, and then there's a bit of pushback, you know, from another I think a woman who was actually providing some perspective on the game is saying he was doing himself a disservice insofar as he's a great coach, but the differences between men and women are less significant than the differences between players, regardless, you know, whether they are men or women. You know, on a team you'll have two players who may have almost nothing in common with the things that they respond to from a coach, that those things will be actually much more powerful in terms of coaching than any kind of thing that we might name as tendencies, right, in male and female athletes, which I thought was really interesting. And then I was like, that is actually one place where I think of class and race, ethnicity is actually really having a lot to do with my own experiences on the field in terms of just like when you're playing with young women who've mainly only played with men, the way that they just sort of roll with things in ways that guys, and here I am reproducing the gender binary thing, but you know, just sort of this kind of like a social ecology to playing with men and a social ecology to playing with women that is much more about the codes of that space than it is about individual people and how they behave, you know, as they interact with that or certainly on their own, you know. And so if a game that you have always played is one where you kind of have to play like a guy, then that will be a pattern of behavior and a skill set that you'll have developed in that environment. And that's not something that's biologically determined, obviously. And I think that when you work with a really diverse class environment, that those kinds of stories will have a lot to do with it.
That's interesting. This is Laurent chiming in now. When we had at our class here, when Carla Overbeck and who came to our class and still coaches at Duke, it was interesting because they were talking about, they felt like a generational shift actually in women's soccer in the United States, regarding technique in particular. Like and both she and there was a few other folks were talking about just the fact that the need for technical sophistication or technical ability on the part of women who had grown up playing largely in male spaces, which she described as her experience, had created a kind of different set of reflexes and technique. So anyway, just to add to that she was suggesting that she felt like she'd seen a change in terms of the women she was coaching over the years from what her generation had been, which I thought was intriguing.
Just to understand, she was explaining that her skill set had developed in a way to emphasize technical ability, whereas that was shifting towards...
Right. I mean, I think it was partly that... The way she put it was that, you know, she and other players had grown up playing in circumstances where they were playing against taller guys or sometimes faster guys, and had to better them technically, you know, like had to be better than them technically in other ways. And so that they, you know, they rose to the occasion, I guess, in a way, by developing a set of skill sets, I guess, that came out of those of playing in a kind of masculine space. I mean, I think it's just, I don't know, you know, I don't know what to make of that, but I just wanted to throw that she had made that point as well. And whereas, you know, whereas in subsequent generations, she's basically coaching women who have always played in organized settings like with other women, basically since they were very small. So that she said she felt like that had actually caused a kind of shift and in some ways a kind of loss of certain, you know, technical skills. I don't know if I'm paraphrasing her exactly right, but that was just part of a bigger discussion we had about the changing nature of the game in the U.S. Between generations.
Can I just jump in on that one? It's David Toms again. That's kind of interesting, but I wonder, is that necessarily an issue for women who are playing with guys? Because if you're, say, like I am, if you're a really short guy playing football, you can't muscle guys off the ball and you kind of develop other ways of playing or whatever. So I wonder, is that as much about gender as it is just kind of dealing with physicality that just exists in variations in both men and women?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to jump in with Jennifer. Yes, I mean, I think it's like, it is actually about size. And Yeah, it's about size and strength. So, I mean, there was just that wonderful picture I saw somewhere of Messi and Marta standing next to each other. And there's actually not that much difference between right. their heights, which is shocking, right? Because she's tiny.
Yeah, yeah. I met her recently. She is tiny.
Yeah, you know, and Messi's just maybe four or five inches taller than her. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really shocking when you look at that, knowing how tiny Marta is, like how I know Messi's a small guy.
Yeah.
Right. But, you know, Messi obviously is a brilliant technical player, and he has to be because he's obviously not going to win the ball on his strength. Right.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And this is a one of the problems that's been, you know, fans of the U.S. women's national team are complaining violently about this because it's really visible that the national women's team players are not playing enough against more skilled players as they're training, you know, and as they're coming up through the development system, that the system is obviously too regimented because you put them up. I mean, England just beat the pants off them. They just, you know, ran circles around them. And the English women were playing, a few of them were like technically just really just so much more confident on the ball than the U.S. women's national team looked. And if you look at the FIFA rankings, that shouldn't be happening. Right? So a lot of people are attributing that to exactly the process that Overbeck is describing. It's also the thing, though, that makes Marta such an exciting player to watch. And the entire Brazilian squad is, from my perspective, right, also as a fan of the women's game, you know, when I saw Marta Brazilian women beat the U.S. in 2007, wow. It was with a game that I hadn't even realized that I hadn't thought that women, I thought women couldn't play like that. You know, on some level, I didn't, you know, it's something I'm aware of, but I was watching them play and I was like, oh my God, I didn't know women could actually play football like that. Both in terms of the beauty of their game and the cynicism of it. You know, there's no reason to imagine that the Brazilian women would be playing a different game than the Brazilian men do, especially given that so many of the women on that team grew up as girls playing with their brothers and with their brothers' friends.
So do you think then that maybe, do you think women's soccer, this is speaking very, very generally, conforms to kind of, say, concept of how the men's national side play football? Or do you think that they actually often play in a very different fashion? So, like, you know, the kind of typically kind of English people punt the ball up the field and kind of chase and are quite physical, but lack kind of good on the ball, on the ground skills. Do you think, like, say that, or however it is, or the Brazilians have a very particular kind of style of play? Yeah. Do you think the women's, do you think they conform to the kind of national stereotype of how they play football, or do you think sometimes they sort of subvert it and actually play the opposite style?
I would think that people grow up people play the game that they grew up watching.
Yeah,
like that would be my my reflexive sort of reaction to that observation. You know that there are differences that. Institutional differences in training, for example, training opportunities, that rather than in terms of style, because I do think people try, they play the game that they've been watching. I mean, I would say even like in the American game, one of the things that I think informs the American game is that a lot of us watch basketball, so, you know, which is a very game of intense physical contact. And so that's just sort of a theory on my part that's purely, you know, science from the sphincter, right? Like I'm just wild guess, you know.
Well,
but
I wonder though too, now that the people around the world are watching more European soccer, so I know here, like, my son is always going to watch Barcelona and Real Madrid play whenever he's skipping school to do it, and the high school team here, they're sort of ripping off Barcelona's playbook and trying to do that. And then throughout the African continent, where people are watching so much EPL particularly, I wonder, and I don't know if people are picking up more of these different styles of play by watching the European play as opposed to, you know, a locally grown version of, you know, learning from your coach, learning from your neighborhood kids, or if there's some mixture of that. I mean, that would be, I don't know if Peter's coming on at some time. Peter probably could speak to that too. If he's
Peter Peter actually had to step out. He wants to say hi to everybody, but he actually had to drive his daughter to practice. So
Right.
He had to step out.
You know, and but we also, you know, in different areas, like here, we have all sorts, you know, people coming in from all over the world coaching. Like my this morning, my son, he was at a little soccer tournament, and the guys were, I think one is Latino, one is from Ireland, you know, the other one's an American, but, you know, so they're all bringing in all these different styles, and I have no idea if that's going to impact their play or not, but one of the things that I was thinking in terms of coaching, and again, this is more of a question and a conjecture, having done a lot of coaching clinics and classes and gone to a lot of sessions, I think there's a tension between, in the United States anyway, between recreational play and play that, you know, more competitive play, and a lot of the kids will go from recreational to competitive, but, you know, what will happen at the competitive level, there seems to be more opportunities for girls' recreational play farther along. The boys, kind of, the recreational side seem to dissipate more as they get older as teenagers. But in the clinics, one of the things that I find positive is that there's more of an attempt to say, okay, you know, it's not just about winning the game. It's about the development. It's about the, you know, experiencing the fun of it and trying to, you know, move both the coaches and the parents away from the, you know, win at all costs sort of mentality. Sure. To you know, more of an appreciation of the kids, the players, and, you know, the game of life, as all that, and working in the sport and development arena, there's also that there now of trying to, you know, see it not just about winning or about getting a contract someplace, but about trying to, you know, use the coaching and the sport to empower people, especially girls. And I mean, I wonder if a lot. I don't know if there's anything particularly gendered about that. Because it seems to be coming from a lot of different places. But I just wonder, because there is this sort of tension in the different, and I see coaches who will say, yes, we're doing this more, I don't know, more progressive type of coaching. And yet when it comes down to it, they revert back to that. We're going to win at all costs and do anything just to win this game, you know? So, even within, you know, coaching staff, in one person, you'll see this tension and result. Yes. But I don't know. Has anybody else noticed that and feel? I don't know if there's anything gendered about that in particular. And again, I'm thinking maybe in the United States because there, you know, there have been women and girls involved more than at least equally as far as boys. I think here in the States, more opportunity for girls here than maybe elsewhere in football. That maybe there's something to that, or I don't know.
Yeah, I don't. I'm kind of stumped when I kind of try to think about gender differences around that. And sort of, I mean, I think one of the things I found eye-opening about watching Brazil in 2007, the women's side, was because there was a pretty infamous moment where I forget which player it was, but she pretty much dived, and the referee gave the American player a red card, and the Americans were already losing the game at that point. But I think they were down 2-0, and then after that, it was, you know, just a bloodbath. But it was a really cynical play. And I, you know, and I, it was something that I associate with the men's game much more, you know, that there's a kind of a romance around, a bit of fairy dust that gets sprinkled over the women's game where we just imagine that women play more clean and less likely to dive and be theatrical. And, certainly in the WPS, it does seem that way. You know, it's sort of like those moments actually really leap out at you, the cynical play. But then I wonder, there's just less at stake. So.
Although I know that, I mean, it's in some of the competitive youth leagues, some of the girls' games that I've seen and watched, and, you know, with the totally femme players, they go for blood. I mean, they are rough and tough and are, they do the cynical stuff as well. And so it's interesting.
You're reminding me, Martha, of why I quit the LA Muni Women's League, which, and I did, you know, I play I pretty much only play co-ed pickup, is the women were so violent. I mean, I actually broke my arm in a it's not even right to say I broke my arm. It's like I got hit by a truck. And, you know, really, I mean, just really foul and nasty play. That was partly also because they
as a practice, which they will tell you to their face, to your face at the LA Municipal League. They assign inexperienced and low-ranked referees to the women's game as a practice. Mm-hmm. I have pointed out ad nauseum that this is in violation of Title IX, which it is, but it doesn't matter unless somebody files a suit, which is ridiculous that you would have to take it that far.
It connects with the reading, though, the one from the Bengal game. That was the novel. That was actually quite fun to read. I mean, I've never seen anybody bring out chains and spike rings to a field, but I've been in games where there's been people bounce down and then bounce up swinging. So.
Yeah, one very experienced referee that I've worked with in a league, he said that he made a gendered observation, which was that refereeing women, and this is, again, purely anecdotal, but I found it very interesting. He said refereeing women is more difficult than refereeing men because, and especially when you're playing on a more competitive, because I think he does high school and he may do college matches as well, because women will foul off the ball and retaliate off the ball. And so you have to have eyes in the back of your head. Because that the women players will be more likely to actually hold on to something and then act on that much later in the game, like an hour later. Whereas with the men, that it was much more kind of direct confrontation, and that the retaliatory acts tended to happen actually on the ball. And something about that just struck me as true on a, you know, again, purely experiential, limited experience sort of thing. But I thought it was a really interesting observation.
It would be actually an interesting research project to do, both talking to referees and players, but then also having some kind of way of, like, analyzing games and trying to figure it out. I don't know if anybody would pay or work on and do that kind of research, but it would be interesting to see if there was, some kind of interest difference that you could measure.
And fouling off the ball. Is that a gendered quality?
I think that's
good. Just evil.
It's funny though, because from my own experience of playing football, usually what I find I do is I remember something happening and kind of going and remembering the guy and go, all right, I'm going to get him, but waiting till he's on the ball to go through him, because that way you might get the ball and you can probably get away with it. So I don't know if that's just being kind of a bit too cute for your own good or what it is, but. That is kind of interesting that it, and the person who kind of made that observation, do you like, was that from like extensive experience or was it kind of really?
Yeah, he's actually one of my absolute favorite conversation partners for football, because he's got, he actually played for a Maccabi team in, I want to say in Chile. And then he's been refereeing for decades in the Los Angeles area. So when, and this actually came up in a conversation we were having about the Elizabeth Lambert ponytail pulling video that I've said on my blog that was probably the biggest story in women's soccer that year, which was also the same year that the WPS was launched, because it got far more play on ESPN. In fact. It was ESPN that actually turned that into a story and made it into a viral video, in essence. And that was what had spawned the conversation, in addition to just sort of our own, because he was referee for a men's league that I was running, and we would have violent confrontations almost every week. I mean, it wasn't not every game, but every week some guy would lose his temper and either throw a punch or come so close to throwing a punch, you basically had to get him off the field. And, and we were having issues where we had to get when you give a guy a red card, you have to make them leave, right? You can't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I never understood that until I was running a men's league and I saw, Jesus Christ, if you don't get them off the field, they'll actually get into a fight.
Yeah.
Although, I also, with the team that my son plays on, the worst incidents have been on the sidelines with the mothers.
Yeah.
And the mothers going at each other.
Yeah. So. Have any of you read the book You'll Win Nothing with Kids, actually, which is a really fantastic book about a guy in England who's managing his son's under-12 team, and basically he has to deal with parents like having fisticuffs on sidelines. And it's something I see myself the whole time just at home at like underage matches and stuff, and because people were, you know, the recent controversy with Wayne Rooney and his shouting "fuck off" into a camera, and it's like, well, kids learn much worse at the sideline probably of their own matches than they will from seeing that on TV. So it's quite strange, but I can imagine knowing my own sister and her, how she feels about her son's under 12 team, I can imagine her kind of getting quite riled up on the sideline quite easily.
And to gesture towards my own kind of background, we're coming from working in gender studies and performance, that one of the things that has drawn me to working on football and has just really hailed me has been that the gender stuff right around the game is very intense. And it's not, you know, it's not localizable to individual bodies. You know, it really, when there's aggression, like physical aggression in the air, people get kind of swept up in it. And again, that it can actually be this environmental affective thing much more powerfully than it is, right? It's not the engine of that. It's not the biology of the people involved. It's the gender dynamics of that social space. The first time I ever felt myself having to pull back from the impulse to throw a punch was playing football in a friendly co-ed match of just some guy who just fouled me ludicrously. And it felt like I was possessed. I mean, I had never in my life, I mean, I was like maybe 39 at that point, never in my life had I felt that rush of aggression, you know, towards another person where I wanted to convert that. I really wanted to convert it into like a physical assault on him. Mm-hmm. And instead, you know, a stream of expletives came out of my mouth, and I'm a pretty aggressive woman too. So, you know, and it's like, it's the physical activity of the game, the intensity of the contest, you know, and it's, you know, I was like, this is really expanding my sense of who I am in my body, you know, and it really, in the same way that for me, maybe going into gay bars in my early 20s did, in terms of giving me a different sense of community and a different sense of, you know, who I was and in relationship to others. Football does the same thing. And then, the men's and the women's game, depending on what space that's emerging from, will have its own codes. I mean, the U.S. women's team sounded like an evil sorority. That was that 2007 World Cup where Hope Solo was benched infamously and said to the camera after the match, you know, she was like, I would have made those saves. And you could hardly blame her for saying that because, you know, she had been performing brilliantly and then was benched in, you know, because the coach was afraid of Brazil and thought Brianna Scurry would be better because she had more experience playing Brazil. And the camera through the whole match just kept going to Hope Solo, sitting there sulking and scowling and, you know, biting her nails and just looking at like misery itself sitting on the bench. And for that, you know, she wasn't allowed to attend. I think she wasn't even allowed to attend the third place match. And then she flew home on a separate plane. And then apparently during the training camp afterwards, you know, she was sitting at a completely separate bench, you know, like, I mean, a table for, you know, and meals and stuff, you know, that players had isolated her. And this had a lot to do, apparently, with the coaching changes that were made from, I'm taking this from a Grant Wall profile, which was a really great article about the aftermath of all of that. And, you know, that sounds like, you know, certain kinds of feminine spaces from a certain kind of class, sort of middle class, you know, college, sorority cliquishness, you know, I mean, I was scandalized that that a team could have had that kind of a thing going on. I was really like, oh my God. And I think that's what Pia Sundage said when she came in, this is not a sorority. You know, you guys have to get over yourselves. and, you know, that's an interesting side of the story about the U.S. women's national team, too, to go, you know, is that there was this kind of transitional period in relationship to the UNC Chapel Hill squad and the kind of fluid interaction between the national program and that. And the sort of social ecology of the team was certainly coming right out of UNC Chapel Hill. Anyway.
Oh, hi, this is John Turnbull. Do we still have time?
Yeah, absolutely. We usually run around 90 minutes, so we're cruising towards the end here, but yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to say a couple of things about the Longman book. which I haven't read in a while. I read it a while ago. I don't remember liking it especially that much, but one of the things that I remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that well, the most interesting thing in that was his portrait of the Chinese system. There's a chapter in which he portrays the Chinese players, which I thought was the most interesting part. But all the U.S. players, and it seems so long ago now, even though it wasn't that long ago, but they all had, I'd call sort of systemic sports backgrounds or systemic backgrounds in football. That is, they came up through the system and played organized soccer much of their lives. And I think that that's one of the things that's right. Speaking specifically about the U.S. women's structure and the elite players. I think of them as quite, and I know that you know, one of the things that gets played down about the U.S. women is the fact a couple of times after that 99 event and fought for themselves and made an important statement in that way. But for the most part, I think of them as elite U.S. women's players as having come up through a system and playing sort of a domesticated game. And it's raised, one of the things the Longman book does is on what occasion and in what circumstance do we get to hear a woman's actual attitude and opinion about the sport that they play. Because the occasion for that book was a jingoistic triumph. It was a United States victory in a World Cup final. And that's what produces books on sport, is triumph at the highest level, is triumph on the biggest stage. And that's how we get to learn about these women, is from a situation of high achievement and great triumph. And one of the things is watching U.S. women's games on TV for a long time, the thing that strikes me about it is the absolute fear that the broadcasters have and the commentators have that we'll learn anything about players from the other team who speak another language. And the fear of anything beyond the domesticated, tame women's sporting style that we know or that we're comfortable with. So, you know, how is it that we're going to learn these things about these women as individuals, as human beings, their experience of playing, their failures as players, their anxiety as players, anxiety that they have with their identity or with how they express themselves. It just seems like, and I've just noticed this over the past few years, is how tame conversation and writing is about women's soccer when it does happen, and it happens very rarely.
Yeah, I think I may have found out about this story on your blog, John, was Gay Taleze's, or I'm not sure how to say his last name, profile of the Chinese player who missed the penalty kick in that 2007 right. game. And one of the, this is actually a chapter in his book, I think it's called The Writer's Life.
And, Gay Taleze.
Yeah, and I think it's an interview on your blog, John, where he talks about how he tried to sell that story. And he struggled to pitch that story to editors, which would be like a no-brainer in the men's game. You know, that the player who fucks up and loses the game of the World Cup final, that's a great story. I mean, one could say that's Zidane, right? I mean, and the headbutt. Right. I mean, it's not that alone lost the match, but and he couldn't sell it, right? Because there's no room. What you see in the sports media is what they want around the, in general, what you want is like the underdog story that triumphs generally. And then you have kind of like the women's game in general as a underdog phenomenon itself.
And so all that is that can be accommodated is, you know, the story of the triumph and the win, or just straight up kind of boosterism for the women's game. Like there'll be, you know, no doubt some previews of the Women's World Cup that'll be telling you what to look out for. But you won't have an in-depth kind of reporting at all, right? For example, I mean, I think the no Nigerian thing is scandalous. I mean, I just can't believe that's not really being dealt with. You know, or Yudi Simulane, or that's not even a new story now. I mean, they've got, you know, the U.S. women's team, I mean, just going into the World Cup, they look horrible, you know, and we're not getting anywhere near the kind of coverage of why, like what's going on, like what this should be much more controversial than it is. And there's just so little space given to the women's game, to soccer in general. And then the women's game after that is just, yeah, as you said, you just get this really one dimensional sort of vision of the game. I mean, one of the things that I like about Go for the Gold, the Mia Handbook, which actually few people who haven't read it realize, is that it's actually not, as much as I would like, you know, to know more about her personally, it is about her attitudes about playing the game. It's you know, her experiences playing the games and the wisdom that's given her. It's one of the very best books on actually playing soccer that I've read. You know, and you can't find that book in England, which I don't understand. And even now, you know, it's not really sort of as alive as it really should be. I mean, it's the best book, I think, in English, and certainly by an American player, for handing to a young player, giving them instruction on how to play the game. And a lot of that is narrated in relationship to her experiences in specific matches and sort of, you know, her own learning process and learning curve as a player. And, you know, there really are very few examples of what that might look like.
Yeah, I'm discouraged at this point. I was on a conference call last year with the chief executive of women's professional soccer, and this was shortly after the study from University of Southern California had come out with showing that women's sports in the States get less than 2% of airtime, which has been declining over time. And I just wanted to ask her what thoughts that she had for the WPS having any hope of succeeding when such discrimination existed and lack of interest in women as athletes and women as elite players. And she's disagreed very strongly. She said there's no discrimination toward women's sports, professional women's sports.
How can you say that?
Yeah, and I wanted to go to the dictionary because I thought I'd forgotten what discrimination meant. And I just felt like that's why I used the word domesticated, because there seems to be this kind of passive acceptance.
Yeah.
You know, when you talk about, I live in Atlanta, and the Atlanta Beat has had two versions. They had a version here in the WSA, and then they have a team now. And the owner of the team, who I've talked to a few times, when they were placing the team, all these teams, I think I'm right, in the women's leagues, it's called the Atlanta Beat. They don't play in Atlanta. They don't play anywhere near it. It's been shunted out as far as possible into where they think their market is, into the suburban areas. And it's they call it a women's soccer specific stadium, which all that means is that the pitch is exactly the same size as any other pitch. It's just there are very few stands. You know, it's women's soccer specific in that the stadium will only sit 6,000 people. They used to get 8,000 or 9,000 or 10,000 for the Atlanta Beat when it played here about 8 or 9 years ago. So it seems to be that kind of passive acceptance of that niche, you know, and there's no discrimination. It's just we don't market well enough. I mean, that's the thing. It's you win, you gain attention by marketing. You don't fight against anything, societal force or anything.
And this is where leagues actually do themselves harm. I was just talking with corresponding, I'd say, on Twitter and email with the people behind Free Darko. They've actually just sort of retired their blog, but that was a fantastic site. It was a sort of graphic designers and artists. One guy in particular doing kind of style analytics on the NBA. And then they have a series of posters of NBA stars that are absolutely gorgeous and really interesting artwork. I ordered one of Amari Stoudemire. And I asked him, you know, have you ever given treatment to women players? Like, have you ever covered the women's game in Free Darko, the blog? Because they would do posts about the, you know, actual games and specific players. And they had, and they got a chastising email from the WNBA because they actually talked about the appearance. Because that's what they do, is they actually talk about the look and the style of different players. And just to actually even write about the like the physical appearance of the female WNBA players from the league standpoint, they got mad. Right, and they were like, "We don't want you talking about their looks, you know." And this wasn't demeaning, sexualizing, like, you know what I mean? Like, it was acknowledging that they have different looks and different styles, and that there's different ways to read those styles. They were at least trying to get a conversation going about, you know, the visual dimension of the WNBA, and that the league actually, you know, came down hard on them. And he never wrote about the WNBA after that. You know, and I wrote back to him. I was like, would you actually, with a men's game, react to the NBA if they told you they were pissed off by something that you said? Obviously, you wouldn't stop writing about the men's game. So some of that is on the blogger, right, for, you know, because expecting the women's league to somehow be happy to get any interest, right? But I think, on two sides, that sort of shows you some of the kinds of problems that around, like, the problem of women's athletics in the media itself, insofar as that people who write about the women's game, where the men's game is their central thing, feel like they should get a pat on the back, right? Just in general. Like, oh, thank you for talking about women, you know, regardless of what they say, which is not how they would approach writing about the men's game. Because, I mean, you write about any sport and somebody's going to get pissed off about what you have to say about it. You know, but then also the league itself has a very aggressive tendency to police the women's game in the same way that, you know, women were policed in the 50s. Not even the 20s, right? But in the 50s, in terms of you know, if you expect to have a job, you need to wear these heels and this color pantyhose and have your hair this way, right? And the leagues will actually run their own athletes and their own visual culture in this really restricted, airless sort of approach. It's a real problem. And where you don't see that in terms of the women's game, a more kind of vibrant, electric, and dynamic thing is in, like, X Games kinds of things, you know, where you see motocross sort of, you'll see, you know, women with tattoos and dreadlocks who are out loud and proud about their lesbianic lifestyle, and then they have tons of guy fans who are absolutely madly crushed out on them. You know, I'm like, why can't we imagine that that's actually portable? And I don't know. Yeah. I'm cutting my rant off now.
No, I would just agree, though, that there is just different expectations, and there's a smaller box for women athletes and women's sports. So there's only so far you can go, and then beyond that, it's too risky.
Yeah.
For various people involved, whether it's the athletes themselves, the coaches, the parents, or the supporters, fans. It's just a very small space.
Well, that we've gone. No, go ahead. No, that we've gone over time is a good sign.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask, just here at the end of our conversation, while we're all here, what we might think we'd like to turn to in terms of either a format or a book that we'd like to read, especially next semester when we have an open slot for another Football Scholars Forum session. If we want to read a book explicitly about women's soccer, if we want to try and, we got to, you know, some of our readings today, but if we want to try and chop up different readings, just general feedback on how this can remain a useful forum for us, above all things.
I think it would be nice to actually have, in terms of the scholarship on the women's game, to actually have an author, given the floor to really talk about his or her own project in the women's game. Be that something that's published or something that's in progress, I think that would be a very good thing.
Certainly, if it's a history, you know, the challenge of the source materials is going to be one of the interesting things to find out how they, you know, overcame those obstacles, or where they looked, where they found things.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And I wanted to bring it up towards the end here, but we've run out of time. But, you know, in my own research, I'm looking at clubs in the 50s and 60s in Argentina, but there has been some scholarship on the women's game in Argentina. It's fairly sparse, and it begins sort of in 1990, where there is, you know, I know there are sources and a story to be told there before that's closer to the years that I'm working on. But that will take a little bit more field work on my part. So I'll bring that back to the group when I get to those sources. But yeah, I think trying to find a work that's either in progress or completed, we can discuss sort of some of the challenges of working with sources or ethnographies in practice in the women's game, and how we can compare that to maybe our own fields of expertise might be useful in the future. So if you have any suggestions, by all means.
I don't know what will come of it, but this June in Sweden during the European African Studies meeting, there's a panel on women's football, and I'm supposed to be writing a paper for it. It's not done yet by any means, but there's some other people that are also going to be contributing that to that panel, and so something interesting may come out of that, so I can see.
And especially for the group library for Zotero, I mean, even if you're not plugged into it and have access to it, if you send me citations, you know, I'll get those on there. And the two suggestions, Pete Davies, I Lost My Heart to the Bells, and the article on the Hackney Squad and Soccer and Society are going to go up after this meeting. So part of what I'm hoping FSF can do in the future is serve as a sort of a repository for people who can't participate in the sessions, but can maybe download them and you know, have a look-see at what we can collaborate with in terms of sources, you know, to wet their beaks more.
Okay.
Great. Well, thanks everyone for making the time to come out, and thank you especially Jennifer for taking on the work of convening, and I very much appreciate that. It's nice to be able to sit back as an observer, and our authors usually fill these roles anyway. So I think you did a fine job of sharing your insight, and
thanks for creating the opportunity, Alex. I really enjoyed it, and I for those of you who, I don't know how many, if I know this, I know there was one person who's been to one of my two. I'm looking at the list now. I'm like, two or three of you guys have been to my soccer salons in Los Angeles. I have little salons every now and again. So if any of you are Southern California based, just drop me a line and let me know that you're in the area, and I'll put you on the email list.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. And have a great evenings.
Yeah. All right,
take care.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.